Hey, welcome to Hellbent, a feminist podcast for those who resist and persist. I'm Devin, and today on the pod, I had the honor to interview Cecile Richards. This was such an amazing interview for so many reasons. But before we get started, I want to just add a personal note here and say that speaking to this woman who I consider to be a personal hero has been a defining moment in both my life and in my career. And if you had asked me a year ago, like I said on Monday's show, if you'd asked me a year ago if I would be interviewing Cecile Richards for my very popular political podcast, I would have pointed and laughed at you. And so this has been an incredible journey. And the fact that I'm here and the fact that all of you Hellions are here with me means so much. So it's pretty clear that in the era of the Trump administration that they are working to dismantle women's rights. From Betsy DeVos and her battle to limit Title IX rights in colleges, to the Office of Refugee Resettlement keeping a pregnant teen from getting a legal abortion, to the attack on Planned Parenthood and the funding during the debate on the ACA repeal and the new tax bill, we are living in a time when the rights of so many women are being systematically dismantled. And there are two stories that I want to go over quickly. The first is a bill in Kentucky was passed in the state legislature and is headed to the desk of Governor Matt Bevin, who has described himself as, quote, 100% pro-life. And this bill would ban abortions after 11 weeks. The purpose is political, not medical. As with all of these bills, as with all of this anti-abortion legislation, it is always about the politics. The Kentucky House of Representatives voted 75-13 in favor of the anti-choice bill, and lawmakers tout that it will ban, quote, bodily dismemberment, crushing, or human vivisection, which is basically taking aim at a very safe, very common in-clinic abortion procedure called dilation and evacuation, or D&E. And this is the first anti-abortion bill to pass in the Kentucky legislature this session, but it comes in the wake of many, many other states signing restrictive abortion bills in recent months. And the vast majority of abortions happen early in pregnancy. And so while for a while anti-abortion activists were going after, you know, making abortion illegal after 20 weeks, the number of abortions that happen at or after 20 weeks is very, very small. And so by starting to take aim at 11-week abortions, 10-week abortions, you're really now starting to impede on the rights at the most likely time that they are to get an abortion. There's also been some bad news out of the Supreme Court. California's Reproductive Fact Act, which requires certain disclosures from anti-abortion, quote, crisis pregnancy centers, is looking like the Supreme Court is going to decide narrowly that the Fact Act is unconstitutional. So there are some very scary things happening in terms of women's rights. But there are extraordinary women at the front of the fight to keep women's rights secure in this uncertain time. And one such woman, as I mentioned, is Cecile Richards. She was the president of Planned Parenthood for 12 years. And while that is her most famous role, she began her career as a labor union organizer and helped to elect her mother, Ann Richards, to be governor of Texas at a time when women, particularly progressive women, particularly women in Texas, were facing an uphill battle in political races. She gave hours of testimony in front of Congress in 2015, in which she not only passionately defended Planned Parenthood and the good work they do, but exposed the fact that the men in the room, mostly white men to boot, didn't care about women's rights as much as they cared about evangelizing their political and religious beliefs. She's a personal hero of mine and a force to be reckoned with. I'm honored to interview her today about her new book, Make Trouble: Standing Up, Speaking Out, and Finding the Courage to Lead. It is a beautiful telling of her life story, but it's more than that. It is a call to action and a blueprint for how you can raise hell, as she calls it, right where you are. And as someone whose entire life mission at this point is to do exactly that, raise hell and rally fellow Hellions to do the same, this book struck me like lightning. And so, with no further ado, my interview with Cecile Richards. Hello?
Hey, is this Devin?
Yes.
Hey, Devin, Cecile.
Hi, how are you?
Great, how are you?
I'm great, thank you.
I love the name of your podcast.
Thank you. It's so funny, you know, reading your book and you saying Raising Hell, that's kind of, we say it a lot on the show, so.
Right, I know. I just like, I mean, I feel like, yeah, we just kind of got to bring back these chestnuts. Anyway.
I agree. So I am so excited to talk to you today.
Equally.
Yeah, thank you. Let's just jump right in.
Okay, great.
So you said in the book that you, like most women, are more comfortable talking about others than about yourself. So why do you think that is?
Well, I think, I don't know whether part of it is being moms, because I mean, sure. I raised three kids and I think you spend a lot of your time kind of like corralling others or all the other things that we do. And I also think women are interested not just in their own trajectory and success, but the success of others. And that, I mean, I learned that at an early age, and that was sort of one of my mom's big, I guess, lessons to me. So I do think we certainly never want to be, you know, self-promotional. We don't want to be braggy. And also I think we recognize that one person can't get anything done.
Right.
And that's what's been so exciting this last year, is just to see women supporting other women, women, you know, being in community with other women, even complete strangers. I can't tell you how many women I've met who are now good friends with the people they went to the Women's March with that they had never known before.
Right.
You know, and so now they started groups and stuff. I just think that we think more communally, and that can work. I think that can work to our advantage as well.
Yeah. Do you think that concept that women work together and, you know, talk about other people and keep that focus on the community, has that affected the way that women interact with the political process?
I think in a sense, because look, the way, and I definitely, it's interesting to look at the trajectory of women, like in the United States Senate, because I spent a lot of time with them, and none of them went to the Senate because they thought, oh, I'm the perfect person, or I'm the greatest. They really went because they wanted to get something done, and which is why I actually think they do get more done, because they're not there just for their own self-promotion. They're there to solve problems. And that's true actually for Republican and Democratic women.
Yeah.
I mean, I think my favorite example is Patty Murray, of course, who just was such a practical get things done kind of person, and has now risen to be one of the most powerful senators in the United States, and yet totally behind the scenes, right?
Right.
Not in a big flashy way. I hope though, and this is the work I'm really focused on doing, particularly as I move aside from my role at Planned Parenthood, is I think that for a lot of women, politics has not been a very inviting place, and it hasn't necessarily seemed as a place you go to solve problems. But I think it's absolutely critical that you know, women, not only that we you know, it's important to march and call your member of Congress and go to town hall meetings and do all the things that women are doing, but voting is essential. And when we vote, we really change the trajectory. I was just back in Texas, actually, where 58% of the primary voters were women. Mm. And that is a big, big difference. And I think, again, we're seeing women of color make the difference in critical races across the country. So I just hope that we can change the culture so that women find power and political power and changing it something that is as appealing as all the other work they're doing.
Yeah, I want to talk about your mother's campaign for Texas governor. I think my favorite line in the entire book is, "We'd beaten the odds and elected a divorced, recovering alcoholic, feminist, progressive woman to be governor of Texas."
That was it.
Yeah, odds stacked against you. Has that optimism stayed with you of that campaign and that success?
Well, I mean, I talk about in the book too, that as progressives, if you're trying to do something really, well, if you're not trying to do something really hard, you're probably not setting your sights high enough.
Right.
But often we're trying to do things that seem nearly impossible. And of course, sometimes they are impossible until you do them. So I wouldn't say that mom's success was like a prescription for, oh, we can just kind of repeat this all over the country. But I have seen in just this last year, look, you know, African-American women turning out and organizing and electing a Democratic senator from Alabama, which people thought was impossible. Seeing, you know, the first transgender woman ever elected in the Virginia Assembly. We saw, you know, a woman just recently, you know, winning a really tough race in Wisconsin, despite all the money against her. So I do think that women can beat the odds, but I think one of the keys to doing that is women turning up, you know, showing up and turning out for them. That to me is the hope I have for this November and certainly for the presidential election a couple of years from now.
Yeah. So the title of your book and the call to action at its core is, of course, Make Trouble. And you've been doing so since you were young. But how can women who are just now getting into the political process make trouble of their own?
So I think we have to really demystify the whole idea of making social change. Like, it's important to me that women don't feel like, okay, now I've got to quit my job and spend 24 hours a day doing everything, because it just is going to take everybody doing more than they're doing right now. And that's what I've seen this year. So for some people, that may mean volunteering as an escort at Planned Parenthood. For other folks, it may mean making a contribution to a woman candidate. For someone else, it might be showing up at a march. And believe me, I've met so many women who never marched in their life, including women in their 80s who are now marching. And then for some women, it's going to mean throwing it all in and running for office. And I'm seeing that as well. So I think the important thing is to, you know, don't wait for instructions and just do more than you're doing. And I think that one important thing to remember is if you're not scaring yourself, you're probably actually not challenging yourself enough. And I hope that, and that's what I'm seeing across the country, even on this book tour, is women just coming out in droves because they really want to be part of the change. And they're just looking for some simple ideas and encouragement to do so.
Yeah, I'm not going to lie. I cold emailed your publisher to get this interview and it was terrifying.
Hey, good for you. So that's great. So you did the first thing. Right. That's exactly right. And right. That's what's important. And again, I mean, I've seen, you know, young women running for office that no one would have ever asked them to run for. I love right. that more than anything.
Right. So how can we better encourage young women and even girls to get into politics and organizing earlier in life?
I think we have to just support them, lift them up, mentor them, invest in them. I was actually just in at the march in Washington for gun reform and gun safety and, you know, against all the gun violence. And a young woman stopped me. She was in high school and she said, you know, I live in a rural part of Pennsylvania. It's very conservative. And I walked out the other day during the walkout, but I was the only person, she said, although then my friend came out. So that was good. And then they got suspended. And I said, that is great. I mean, yeah. You have now done something so brave. And she said, you know, and a lot of my friends later said, I wish I'd gone with you. And I said, like, that's just the beginning of being an organizer now. So I hope her parents are supportive, but if not, the rest of us need to be. I think women are taking all kinds of risks. We need to we definitely need to invest more in young women of color who are shaking the foundation in this country, but don't always have the, you know, institutional support or financial support to do so. So to me, it's just looking around and seeing what can we do, not only to do more ourselves, but to support folks who are really jumping in a big way.
Yeah. So I know that in your time at Planned Parenthood, you faced, you know, congressional hearings and a lot of opposition. Do you think that people are understanding what Planned Parenthood is more these days? Is there a shift in the conversation?
Absolutely. And, you know, I spent, I think, the first chapter actually talk about that congressional testimony because it was really pretty terrifying. I mean, they were, you know, we have five congressional committees that were supposedly investigating Planned Parenthood, more than the Enron scandal. I mean, more than the financial crisis. It was everything was, you know, it felt like both barrels were focused at Planned Parenthood. And I got through that hearing with a little help from my friends, I guess. My son Daniel texted me in the middle of the hearing and said, Mom, I'm so proud of you. You're doing a great job. Said, I think raising me all these years really helped you prepare for this hearing today. But the interesting thing about that was that in those 5+ hours, millions of people learn more about what Planned Parenthood does, the healthcare that we provide, and also some of the most ridiculous attacks on us from members of Congress, and our approval rating grew. In fact, one of the great ironies of all this is I just saw a Fox News poll from 2 weeks ago, which they had to release, and I'm sure they didn't want to, that said that in their own polling, that Planned Parenthood was the most popular organization in the country.
Wow.
And so I think in some ways, I mean, that's been our theory at Planned Parenthood. As my friend Dawn Legans, who works with me, says, you know, if the idea is to make lemonade out of lemons, we're like a lemonade factory over at Planned Parenthood. And we just have to do that.
Yeah, that's fantastic. So you faced 5 hours of congressional testimony against all of these people. Mm-hmm. They've spent so much more time on this than actual scandals.
You're right.
Clearly tough as nails. So what does scare you?
Well, all kinds of things scare me. And I think it is important to acknowledge that, because I don't want anyone, and even as we're going around on book tour talking to young women, I don't want anyone to think like, oh, she's just this unique person that is never afraid of anything. I mean, I was afraid to go to the interview at Planned Parenthood. I was afraid, definitely afraid of going to the congressional testimony.
Right.
But then I just did it anyway, and a lot of other people supported me. So I think the important thing is it's okay to acknowledge your fear and then go on and do it anyway. My mom used to say something that was really important, and there's a lot of Ann Richards, you know, wisdom sprinkled throughout the book. But she just said, you know, think about what's the worst thing that could happen. If there's something that's you're afraid of, just imagine the worst thing that could happen. And if you can get over that, then you're going to be okay. And believe me, she had been through pretty much every worst thing that could happen, and she got on the other side of it. And I think that just talking about it openly and honestly and not pretending like this is all some, you know, amazingly simple feat is really, really important. I can't tell you the number of women who've come up to me during this last couple of weeks of travel and admitted like they were afraid of doing something, or they stood up and asked a question and they'd been afraid, and then they got over it and now they can go on.
Yeah. And I love that community aspect as well, surrounding yourself with people that will help you.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
You know, you've said before in interviews that you never say never and may run for office. So if you do run, which office would you pursue?
Oh, I mean, I'm not even thinking about it,
no?
Honestly.
Okay.
No.
Okay.
And I, you know, I'm not trying to be coy. I actually just, I feel like I'm really, I've spent my whole life as being an agitator, an organizer, a troublemaker, and I feel really comfortable in doing that. And right now I'm so excited about the number of women who are running and the help that maybe I can give to their success. And if something comes up sometime that I want to run for, so much the better, but it's not my life's dream. I feel like I'm actually living my best life as it is.
Right. Well, yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I have kind of a silly question for you to close
That's
out.
Okay.
You said in the book, during that congressional hearing, you saw Trey Gowdy and you thought that he looked like Draco Malfoy, which he absolutely does. So which Hogwarts house are you in?
Oh my God. I need, this is like, this is one of those things where can't you go like, can I call a friend?
Yeah.
Because I think that my daughter would have a really strong feeling, and I'm so afraid of saying the wrong
the wrong
Hogwarts house. I don't know.
Yeah.
I think it's got to be Gryffindor, right?
Yeah. Oh, definitely.
Okay. Cool. I really hate to make a mistake because all three of my kids are obsessed with Harry Potter. Anyway.
Yeah. No, I grew up in the Harry Potter
okay,
era.
Thank
so.
Goodness I didn't mess that one
nope,
up.
Nope. Not at all. There really is no wrong answer. So.
Oh, I think there are some wrong answers. But believe me, if I said the wrong answer, my daughter Hannah would let me know.
You'd hear about it.
Yes.
Well, Cecile, thank you so much for taking time out of your very busy schedule to talk to me. And
yes. Thank you, Devin. And thanks for having Hellbent. I think this is something, you know, we all need to be more hellbent. And I hope to run into you on the road.
That would be fantastic. Thank you so much.
Okay.
All right.
Take care.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Did you hear that deep breath at the end? I was so floored by my conversation with Cecile that all of the pent up excitement and the adrenaline rush just sort of drained out of me in that moment. But that was one of the highlights of my career. Thank you so much for listening. And I want you to get out there this weekend and raise some hell. In the spirit of Cecile Richards, make trouble. Thank you so much for listening. Drexel and I will be back here on Monday. And on Tuesday, I will be on Good Morning Connecticut at 9 a.m. So if you any Hellions are in the area, you can tune in. Thank you again for joining me on this wild ride. So that's it for me. See you on Monday.